ALO, thanks so much for coming down to Studio C today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Nolan.
Great to be here.
So ALO stands for Animal Liberation Orchestra. Tell our listeners what about liberating your inner animal, and what does that mean to you and your fans?
Well, it starts off as a tiny feeling inside your gut, and then it expands as the animal within comes on the outside.
Is that wow, far out.
Nice answer, Zach.
What happens? Yeah.
Would anybody like to add anything to that?
Well, what was the question again? Now I'm confused.
Tell us about liberating your inner animal. What exactly does that mean to you and to your fans?
Well, yeah, liberate. So we chose this band name back in college, and we wanted the band to be an experience, the music to be an experience where people could come and sort of a
cathartic experience.
A cathartic experience, yeah. Where people could come and liberate their inner animal. And that was sort of like the quote we'd put on our flyers and stuff. And in doing that, we realized that we also could use a little lesson ourselves in liberating our own inner animals. So as time's passed, we sort of have tried to figure out what it means to us and how we can share that with our fans.
When the name Animal Liberation Orchestra kind of has like, you've got the animal, which is feral, and then you've got liberation, which is freedom, and then you've got the orchestra, which is pretty refined and cultivated. And so the three things, I think at any given time within the night, those three words are sort of wrestling with each other, and one's maybe taking over the other at different times. Mm-hmm. Sometimes stuff is really worked out and the plan is being followed. Sometimes the plan has been swallowed and it's
yeah.
And we're just, you know, we're
edge of our seats
along like the audience. And so I think people have come to recognize that quality in the band. I think it makes for an interesting, you never know quite exactly what you're going to get. Although there's a certain amount of consistency over time.
And overall, it's just kind of about being in the moment too, right?
Yeah. Sure.
I assume animals are fairly in the moment, not too worried about the future or the past, or instinctual. And
I think we impart a lot of our personalities on the music and the songs too. So I think in a way, to me, that almost seems like the most consistent thing for the fans.
They that know
they're going to
the
get
same.
Yeah, they're going to get a lot of our four personalities.
I mean, it's funny you choose the name, or the name chooses you, and then you spend like
the rest of your life
trying to figure out like, was that a good name for us? You know,
what does that mean?
Are people like really emotionally involved in it? And you're like, it's just, you know.
It's fun too. We on a simple level, we'll play with the animal theme sometimes and kind of get dressed up with animal costumes or have animal theme night. I mean, not like all the time, but occasionally we'll play with that. The liberation of the animal sort of as a theme in our show.
Yeah, like so many things in life, sometimes it's literal, sometimes it's metaphorical.
Yeah, exactly.
But like so many band names, it's not super meaningful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Most band names aren't.
Right, you right.
Know, it's not like
just a name, brand name or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, going back to what Zach said as far as, you know, constantly figuring it out each year and, you know, fans kind of making up what it means to them, I think that's the sign of a good name, is that it's nuanced and not, you know, just something that's obvious what it means. So.
I do think that it's a charged name, you know, politically. Like I think we didn't quite realize – originally it was the Animal Liberation Orchestra and the Free Range Horns, and we thought like, oh, this sounds like an adventure. This will be fun, and it was happening at parties. And then as it went on, you know, I think that the animal liberation thing has always been sort of like an intense politically charged thing, which is cool to sort of, you know, it's powerful, in that sense that there's a lot of people have, it has a lot of emotionally charged feelings with it, you know, as opposed to just if we had named ourselves Brick or something. You know?
Mm-hmm. Lamp.
Well, I intend to explore politically charged feelings later in this interview. But my second question has to do with your annual tour. So right now at the time of this recording, we're in February and you're in the midst of your annual Tour d'Amour, which I'm sure I mispronounced.
Pretty good.
I think you may have actually been the first person to pronounce it correctly.
Cool. Awesome. Well, what was the initial inspiration for this tour, and what can you tell us about how that tradition has served you and your fans?
Yeah, what was the initial inspiration?
Well, the first one, you guys will remember probably was at Great American Music Hall.
Yes.
And we didn't call it the Tour d'Amour, but we opened for Zigaboo on Valentine's, and it was, right?
Yeah.
And wasn't like a Mardi Gras event also or something?
Yeah, Rex, our same time of year.
I was there too.
You're there? Yeah, sorry. Yeah. And you're there too.
Why aren't you looking at me?
you guys probably don't. But it was like, so it...
I don't remember that.
You don't remember that?
I remember the gig, but I don't remember it being like the first...
Well, that...
We kind of Valentine themed our set.
We sort of Valentine themed our set. And then we're like, we should do that again and like maybe even add a couple shows and we can call it the Tour d'Amour. Yeah. Mm. And so I think we actually let that one be number one and the next one we called number two.
Yeah, which was actually a proper tour where we actually toured around the state with that thing going. We always got into the benefit aspect pretty early on too. It's always been to support music programs for kids, you know, in schools. Various versions of that, but that's something that's near and dear to us. We're all the product of music programs and schools, and so it's, you know, that's, they're getting cut so much. It's one of the things that gets cut first, so we're trying to do whatever we can to
protect it. We wanted to have a tour that where we could donate some money to a cause that we felt passionate about. So the Tour d'Amour has become that also. But yeah, it's been growing. It's the 11th annual.
I mean, celebrating love. That's really the inspiration behind it, you know?
Yeah, this is our biggest one yet, too. We're actually, in the past, it's always been just in California. And this year, we're taking it all the way up into Washington and Oregon. So we're excited about that. It's going to be a bigger thing, which is cool.
Yeah, I think that's really, really great that, you know, you can give back to the music community in this way by... you know, funding these programs. That's awesome.
Yeah, it almost just feels right because we wouldn't, I mean, I think we've all talked about, we wouldn't be here without that, those opportunities that we got just by going to regular old schools.
Yeah, we had some good programs, the four of us. So,
real briefly, what were those programs called and where were they hosted?
Zach and Dan and myself grew up in Saratoga, California in the South Bay. Like a suburb of San Jose, and we went through the Saratoga School District, and they had choir programs and band programs, and
jazz.
It was
band.
All through the public school. We had like a singing teacher in like fifth grade or fourth grade, Miss Esposito. Mm. So it was always kind of encouraged.
It's probably pretty rare.
Probably pretty rare. So yeah, we were sort of being, and yeah, I played violin in fifth grade and sax in sixth grade, and Brogan, you seem like you had a pretty good music program, too.
Yeah, I grew up in Tulare. all throughout the valley, there were schools here and there that in the San Joaquin Valley, that is. There were schools here and there. Not every school district, but a lot of school districts had really pretty solid, active music programs. And I mean, for me, it was just a couple of really good teachers. And the fact that there was a good teacher at the junior high school level and actually even grammar school level. I started, you know, working with her in fifth grade and she was really good. Her name was Susan Chagoyan. So she was grooming. We had a really strong jazz band, you know, went to competitions, stuff like that. And so she was getting people groomed to be pretty good by the time they hit high school. And so then that just made the high school program even stronger. We had a really great director in high school named Bill Ingram and really active parents, which is really important. Yeah. They you know, raised a lot of money for the band, which allowed us to do a lot of stuff. And some good musicians out in that area of California.
Were they doing fundraising in Saratoga too?
Yeah, music boosters.
Yeah, band boosters.
So that it probably needed a little extra
huge
support.
Parental involvement.
Yeah, that's a big part of it too. Yeah, it's the family's involvement and everything. It was definitely supported in the community, valued.
Probably by families who grew up with programs themselves. Yeah, yeah. Wanted exactly. to give back.
Yeah.
So I'm going to switch gears here. Everyone in this band is constantly involved in not just this project, but various projects outside of the band. And I'm really impressed with the time management and ability to coordinate everything. I'm wondering, were there any growing pains along the way of figuring out how to, you know, put that musical schedule together? Or has it always been like a pretty well-oiled machine as far as getting everything done.
Definitely growing pains,
yeah,
you know,
for sure.
And you know, continue, you know, it's always something. I mean, scheduling is complicated stuff.
It really is.
Yeah. In all of life, between having kids and wives and girlfriends and multiple bands, you know. But I think from the get-go, we've always all had that.
Yeah. I think we all like to stay pretty busy too, so it's kind of in our interest to lean in that way. Like, I think some people maybe don't want to be as busy, so they kind of keep it more chill. But I can speak for myself. I just kind of like doing music as much as I can. So, for me, I'm like happy to deal with the troubles of scheduling to like keep music in my life a lot.
Yeah, I think a lot of, you know, professional musicians have the exact same problem. I mean, they've got a schedule. You know,
right.
They've got multiple obligations, different projects that support them at various levels, and they have to make it all work out to make a living.
Even before touring, you know, I remember like I'd be like teaching at the elementary school, and then like I got to get across town to this musical, and I'd be like hitting traffic, and you're like, oh my God, you know, it's always, it's part of the, it's, and it continues where you're like, oh, you know, there's, you know, we're going to go to do radio in Chico, but like there's this big storm. So like we need to account for like, you know, extra hour lead time to make sure like, you know, just to get from point A to point B on time.
We've had some different moments of downtime in the band too, where people, you know, there's some kids, some of the guys in the band has kids. And so sometimes that's like a little downtime, a little off time. So I think people who want to work will go and find work, and then they'll maybe start like a new obligation with somebody else or whatever. But these windows open up, and then you're kind of like at certain points, you're sort of juggling lots of different things. And maybe that person that had a kid at that point is now ready to tour again. So you sort of have to like finesse that.
Yeah.
But we keep the communication lines real open as to what people want to do. And we try to like really figure it out well ahead of time. And it's, you know, it's well oiled at times and it's sticky at other times. And
yeah, there's a lot of this sort of feast or famine kind of thing that goes on. Like, I even just find that personally, like I'll be saying no to all these things at this one time. And then there might be some time where I'd totally be available. I could do any
one
of them.
One.
Yeah, like,
right.
Like, but it's just funny. It's just the nature of it, I think.
I mean, we're the pioneers of the gig economy, which is apparently the direction that most people's lives are going to be going in the next.
For musicians.
20, yeah.
Or even just
for
like
everybody.
Right. Being independent.
Yeah.
It's definitely, you got to hustle. There's definitely a hustle
independent,
thing.
Independent, just self-employed.
Yeah,
person.
Totally. Totally.
It's complicated.
I imagine there are some amazing creative benefits too, though. Like when I think of people who play with a lot of different projects, I think of like Jimi Hendrix and how he, you know, really became a guitar, you know, legend because he was constantly jamming with different people and learning from those experiences and then taking them back into his own writing with his, you know, original projects and stuff. So
yeah, I think that's benefited our band a ton. All the different things we've done individually, we definitely bring them back in. I also think it's been nice. It's made the band sustainable in a way, because I sometimes think of it like there's these, like, you know, if you put a circle around what you're into, we each have these like circles, right? And then ALO is where they intersect. And back in the old early days of the band, when it was just ALO for us all the time, it was a little tough because you're trying to get all your yayas, all your musical things out in this one band, and sometimes you're pulling people to a place where they're actually not really comfortable. So it's kind of cool with all this stuff going on. I think it all influences ALO, but it also lets ALO be like the ALO, like what everyone's into, rather than trying to drag someone into something they don't want to do.
Well, speaking of collaborations, back in the day, this band ALO formed in Santa Barbara, and you guys were friends with Jack Johnson and did a lot of performing alongside him, and even I believe Zach has supported him on tours on keys. So I'm curious, what has it been like? How has that relationship like influenced your path, both creatively and professionally, pursuing a career as musicians?
For me personally, Jack was a huge inspiration, like both like as a, you know, he was like a songwriting friend, and as his career started to take off, was like right around the time I had like my first daughter was born, and I was sort of going through a like, oh man, like maybe, you know, touring isn't the path for me. And he was actually really and it was long before I was like playing in his band, but he was just really was just like, hey man, just keep writing songs, it doesn't matter like if you have a kid or if you and I remember that was just helpful at the time. So it's nice that like, things that his success, kind of is he's, done a lot to shine a light onto us, mm-hmm. which has been pretty helpful.
He's become like a sort of like not like a huge factor, but a factor for us in our band because, Zach plays in his band for once, or that's happening. And then we're also signed to his record label, mm-hmm. and we've also done a lot of tours supporting him and collaborations in different ways.
Yeah, we share a lot of fans.
So he's like he's actually a pretty big part of our career in a way, and has given us lots of opportunities for work in a sense as well, and we've taken advantage of that and done the best we can with it. And he's a great supporter and a good friend and fun person to collaborate with. And yeah, it's nice to have that sort of community of musicians. He's one piece of many people that we many people that we collaborate with and work with and lean on at times and et cetera. So, yeah.
Well, going off of the having kids thing and Zach mentioning that, I was researching some of your past interviews and I was really taken aback by one conversation you guys had about balancing the lifestyle of being a dad and a musician by what you call scheduling inspiration, which I thought was really really interesting concept because typically, most people say like you never know what's going to come, you can't control it, and you just got to answer it when it calls. But I thought that was interesting to hear that you guys are able to kind of find a way to quote schedule inspiration. I'm wondering if that is still working out. This was like 4 years ago. Does that still something that you can kind of access and control these days?
Well, it's one of those things where you can't necessarily control it, but you can schedule it and you can do everything in your power to sort of summon mm-hmm. summon the forces, I mean, I've gone to the point where like I even have like a little like creativity mantra when I have the time that I'm like that I try to bring in. I actually read this great book called The War of Art that was by an author. I can't remember the name, but he talked about that a lot of times people, one of the reasons for not doing something is sort of being like, oh, I don't have the time for it, And he was just like, you just do it. And he had this quote that he used from the Odyssey that was sort of like a summoning of like the fates to sort of bring this, vessel back to its, back home or whatever. And so I kind of like do a similar thing, try to get in my creativity state. And then sometimes it comes and sometimes it just doesn't. But most of the time it does, mm-hmm. Most of the time I'm like, oh, no, here comes the bell's going to ring and I have to leave my special creativity garden.
Yeah, it's almost like your best bet, I think, is to try to create the context for things. And then, you release and it maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. It kind of reminds me of this thing. It's like a weird parenting thing. It was I read. It was about overpraising children. There's like these two sides, the like tough love side, but then there's the like real lots of love side, which I definitely go on the lots of love side with the kid. But I was reading this thing about overpraising. It was interesting. They were talking about how like, oh, your kid wanders over to the piano and they play a little something and then you like, oh, that's amazing, blah, 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 all this stuff. And this guy was saying, he's a child psychologist. He was like, you know what? The best thing you can do is actually just kind of be quiet and like the best, because you make it about you, But if you can, the coolest thing you can do is just try to create the context for those things to happen. Kind of stay aside for a little bit. Be positive, But don't make it all about you and attached to your praising, But it kind of reminds me of that with inspiration.
Totally.
Same thing. Like the best bet is just try to create contexts for it. And some of them will land.
They'll
latch and sometimes they won't. But like the more context you can kind of create, with your surroundings or your schedule or all these kinds of things, or the people you surround yourself with, all that just leads to hopefully inspiration.
Well, I want to wheel it back to talking about the tour a little bit more for a second. I saw a post online about, someone suggesting that maybe this tour d'amour more, is inspired by love, needs to be extended for the next 4 years to inject some more love and good vibes into our current turbulent political landscape. Would you care to comment on how politics has influenced your more recent songwriting or even just your approach to crafting your live performance?
We're talking about politics a lot in the van. So that's, we're watching some news and trying to pay attention to what's going on and make sense of it all. It's probably influencing our writing individually, I'm sure, in many ways. But
what's funny, like, you know, I don't sometimes think of ALO as being like politically overt sometimes, but as right. As we have these conversations in the van, and as I was like, we were playing "More It Hurts" last night, mm-hmm. which is a Pledge of No Allegiance, into Lady Loop,
yeah,
into both like political. Barbecue soul searching, yeah. And I was like, actually, this is about like a social political. Yeah. It's all pretty much wrapped up in there.
Well, I got a bunch of stuff left yeah. over from the Bush years.
Yeah,
so oh,
yeah,
still playing.
That's, I know.
Just working
raw
great.
Material.
Working
there
great
actually
again,
is also. A lot. It's just like a degree. It's not. Straight up in your face.
Yeah.
But there's actually tons of over. That's like yeah. what Undertow was. The same thing from
yeah.
that era.
Yeah, yeah. We're
same.
Not. We're not.
It's real straight up. But just slightly veiled. Like in a little bit. But I actually had a recent experience that got me thinking a little bit. There was this tribute to the Summer of Love over at the Fillmore a few weeks ago. And we closed with All You Need Is Love by the Beatles. And it was really beautiful. Everyone was, you know, it was a big, you know, sold out Fillmore. People's arms were around each other. Everyone was singing. We were going around on the chorus thing. We like just extended it. There was probably 20 people on stage, something like 20 people. And we were all singing, and it felt like so good. But I actually, like that night when I went home, I kind of was reflecting on it, and I was feeling like that wasn't totally true. Actually, for me, where I'm at right now, like it's like love. Yes, you have to have love first, but that's not all you need. So it got me kind of on a little bit of a search.
What else do you need?
Yeah, well, I found that Indivisible website that's up now, and that got me pretty mm-hmm. inspired because it was like, okay, cool, we have love and we care about our causes, but here are some things you can actually do, some action. You know, it's like all we need is love and action.
Love, maybe
that's,
is
I guess
a,
what I was
love
doing.
Is maybe a catalyst.
Yeah, you need know? Love, but I don't. At that night, at least, I was reflecting. I was like, well, I don't think it's all you need.
There's a really good article online that compares that very concept, and it examines the lives of John Lennon versus Trent Reznor, and mm-hmm. it's a kind of an interesting comparison because I guess Trent Reznor wrote a song called "Love Is Not Enough,"
yeah,
and it's interesting to see that to explore that concept.
Well, you know what is love? I mean, it's like starts to get. Pretty abstract, but you know, when you start being like, okay, like I love my daughter, mm-hmm. you know, what am I willing to do for this love? I love my wife. What am I willing to do for this love? I love my brothers in the band. What am I willing to do? How far am I willing to take this? Like, I think sometimes like when I think about like Martin Luther King and like his love of Jesus, you know, like that love of Jesus was like, he was willing to put his life on the line and march. Like that was a powerful mm-hmm. kind of love, maybe different than like my love of, you know, coffee. Yeah. Made, like a lot
that's
different.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I feel yeah. like the...
So it's like, what kind of love are you talking about? You
yeah.
know?
The political climate's like really kind of... Love is kind of a buzzword, and it's almost like... I feel like the...
Well, there's been so much hate.
I feel like the left gets sort of like the love word, and the right gets the
yeah.
hate word. I don't know. You know, it seems like it's sort of divided that way. But I think it's interesting. I think that general election really made people think a lot about people's words and people's actions. And I liked you made a post the other day, Dave, about the golden rule.
Yeah, that's definitely one that's
do unto others. Yeah, like
don't hear much about that one. It'd
be nice to see people apply that a little more.
Yeah,
but
that's some old world biblical. Commandment stuff, right?
Well,
where the golden rule comes out of?
Yeah.
Immanuel
yeah.
Kant is a famous philosopher who actually invented it.
Oh, he's the golden rule.
And then it later was known as the golden rule. But that was my favorite philosopher in a philosophy class because I'm like, oh, dude, that is so fundamental.
Yeah, it's so basic.
So fundamentally true that. Yeah.
Well, it actually comes from the Bible, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. He says, do unto others, what are the two commandments? Or what are the basic commandments? One was love God as much as yourself, and the other one's do unto others as you have them do unto you.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
But it's been, of course, golden rule.
The golden rule.
You didn't call it the golden rule, but...
Yeah, right, right.
It's sort of the basis for any society.
Civil.
Really.
Yeah.
Yeah, civil society.
Yeah.
I think our songs might not be like directly political, sometimes a little closer, but I think we try to show optimism and things like that, you know, like love, I guess love in some sort of way, and searching for what love is and what it means. And but I think our songs have some of that stuff, and I think that can apply to politics. And
would it be totally weird to plug a website right now?
No.
Well, I don't know. You mentioned you did. Oh, you did.
Well, that invisible guy.
This one's a little less serious, but you did mention the. Well, this one's mine, so this is. Hopefully, it's not weird. Okay, I'm doing it.
This can be edited out.
You may totally be edited out if we go there and look at it and don't like. We'll just edit it out. Anyway, you mentioned in like the next 4 years. So I built a little. I'm kind of getting into building websites, and I built a website that has, it's a countdown clock to the end of the Trump administration. And it looks like a time bomb. The countdown clock looks like a time bomb. And it's got a great graphic on there of like these flames shooting out of Trump's eyes and incinerating the White House.
Is it like funny?
Yeah. You haven't gone there yet?
No. I didn't know you.
But anyway, it's also a handy tool if you're wondering how many days left of the torture.
Oh, gosh.
You know, it's something right now like it's like 1,100 days or something.
Well, I have a thought too along that timeline. Actually, I was talking to a friend, and we had this kind of same discussion going about, you know, oh well, in 4 years, right? But really, like it's really 2 years because of the congressional elections and stuff.
Mm, things
and,
could change.
And you could
quite
really
a bit.
Like a huge shift could happen in 2 years. So that's cool.
Or 2 weeks.
Yeah,
or
right,
two
right.
Weeks. Who knows? It's just
a
lot of disruption, a lot of change.
But my friend told me, she said, anyone says 4 years, remind them that it's also 2 years. That's good for me to remember because I wasn't thinking that way. So.
Yeah, as long as we can undo all that gerrymandering, we might have a shot.
Right.
Are we supposed to love Trump, you think?
Some
people would say that, you know, like, yogis maybe, or like, you know.
Give him the love. Do unto him as you would want done unto you. I mean,
well,
but he does have to be held
accountable. What would you want someone to do to you if you did a certain action that you don't agree
the
with?
The golden rule.
I might want to lock myself up in a prison.
Yeah,
I could be okay with him getting locked up in a prison.
The golden rule is tough because it assumes that you have like kind of ultimate empathy and self-knowledge. That's where it falls short. But right. How would you – it's easy to sit over, you know, not be him and say, well, how would I want to be treated if I was him? What would I deserve?
Yeah.
I think everyone deserves love.
Yes, I think so.
Well, I'm going to change the change the topic again to – I want to talk about with Dan actually about, you know, your approach to guitar playing, because what I find really interesting is that you have such a intentional guitar tone and such kind of unusual, approach to like crafting this very specific tone for whatever serves the moment of the song. But you play an acoustic guitar, which is, I think, very unusual for what you achieve, with your guitar playing. So I'm wondering, as opposed to an electric. And so I'm wondering, what is it about the acoustic guitar? Is it just the actual feel of the instrument that really helps you out? What is it about that versus an electric guitar that is more appropriate for ALO?
Well, so for me, I use the acoustic guitar, but I use it electrically most of the time. I mean, I didn't just on the song we did here because we were literally acoustic, but, you know, 99% of the time for me, it's plugged in. So it's being used like an electric. And the reason for me, I think I've noticed this with a lot of guitar players. Some guitar players tend to be like a many guitars kind of guitar player, like different guitars for each song. And then other guitar players, which I think I kind of fall more in this camp, are usually more of a one instrument or maybe two instrument kind of person. And I think the reason I fall into that is because for me, it's just become very comfortable. I know it well. I really like have a relationship with it. So for me, I want to just be as free to express as I can in any given moment. And honestly, when I switch instruments a lot, like I have to kind of calibrate myself. So I actually just like feel like I can almost get more tones out of one instrument than I can out of using many. But that's just me, you know. Other people like really get into the like strat on this tune, tele on this tune, that's kind of thing. For me, I have a good relationship with the instrument. And so I just like, I like kind of taking the approach of trying to pull as many different kind of qualities out of that one as I can. And it gives me the most freedom to just be in the moment and be expressive, which is kind of what I'm going for all the time.
He's really, Dan has a background in as a luthier too. Every
That's
time I
true.
Play his acoustic guitar, I'm always like, oh.
Feels good.
It feels really good. Yeah. It's like my acoustic
it looks
guitar
beat
doesn't
up.
Feel like this at all.
It's true. After we all went to college together and after, you know, moved up to the Bay Area, you know, move up to the Bay Area and be a musician, and I didn't know anyone except for these guys, so, and we didn't really have that many gigs yet. Or were not really any. So, but I always had interest in that, and I was living at my folks' house, and I needed a job basically. But I went down to get my guitar fixed from the guy who was the luthier all while I was growing up, and his apprentice had just left. So I went and worked with him for about a year and a half, and it was awesome because I
loved
it.
Did he hire you on the spot? Was he like, I have an opening. Do you want it?
He did. Yeah, it was literally. I just moved into town like a week before I was getting my guitar fixed.
Were you like, well, let me think about it for a minute?
No, I was like, that sounds awesome. Because like, nice. I always used to hang out at his shop as a kid, like in high school. I would go there a lot after school because they had kind of a cool thing. His old shop,
huge influence.
Yeah, well, all of us. Yeah, like because totally. We grew up in Saratoga, program. We all got our first instruments there, and I used to go a lot after school because there was. Our friend, his family owned an ice cream shop, so right Aww. Up the, like down the street from there. This is like in high school. It was
know,
more of a prank. Oh, okay. Pranks right. happened there, but okay. but still, it was nice. So we do that, and then it was fun because the guys would all get their guitars fixed, so it was a fun place to hang out because I could kind of like, you know, everyone checks their guitar when they pick it up from the guitar shop, you know, after it's been repaired, and then I could kind of bug him. I was probably kind of annoying. But I always bug him to try to teach me little licks.
I'm sure
things.
He liked to yeah. to help you yeah. out. He was giving back.
This yeah, exactly.
The idea.
So yeah. I still know him. I know him well to this day. We stay in good
Torres
touch,
Guitars.
So. Yeah.
Nice. Another shout out.
And that was Keith Holland,
Torres.
Who I apprenticed with.
I mean, that's
Torres
a huge
is, that's where
thing.
I bought my first bass.
Like people, like older men or women who like totally mentor, you know, like they
Mentors.
See a kid who's
Support.
Like, hey, this kid's mm-hmm. interested in music, and they don't just be like, get out of here.
Yeah.
You know, they were like, hey, check this out. Like, oh, you haven't heard, you know, Randy Rhoads? Like, check this out. You
yeah.
know? And like,
that yeah, was, it's funny because you get
I didn't have an older brother, so I just remember that was kind of a, you know.
Yeah, you got to get influenced you know. As a kid. And that place was full of that for all of us.
Full of musicians yeah. coming and going, you know.
Yeah, they'd give us mixtapes. I remember Haroon, mm-hmm. who worked there, gave me a mixtape that just lived in my car like my whole senior high school. It was on one side, it was the Black Album by Prince. Mm-hmm. And the other side was a mixtape he had made of all like electric blues guys like Albert King, Albert Collins, B.B. King. I mean, all those songs, like every note on every one of those songs is just etched into memory. It's cool. It comes out. It'll probably come out tonight at the show.
Nice. I noticed some activity in the hallway here. How are we doing? Yeah. Do we have time for two more questions?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, we're good.
This is fun.
So this is for all the songwriters in the band. What's the best songwriting tip that you've ever gotten from another musician that's maybe changed your approach to songwriting?
My songwriting tip.
I'll start because I feel like I'm kind of a beginner songwriter still. It's something I didn't like dive into quite the way Zach and Dave and even Dan probably. So I still only have like not even a dozen songs that maybe something like that. But so I'm still picking up tips. So I'm gonna be curious what do these guys say. But when I was working on a song recently, someone told me that I should be more specific. It was like a little too broad, and that. The story I was telling didn't draw them in to like any kind of like specific imagery or whatever. So I think I rewrote the whole song with like a little more specific details, like an actual town name and an actual person's name and, you know, actual things that could kind of make the story something a little more. And so I took that as a good tip for me. I'm still kind of, you know, putting tips together, but that helped me in that song. I thought it turned out a little bit better for me. But yeah, how about you guys?
I got one. Actually, it's actually kind of from Jack Johnson. It was real early on, and I think it was something he said his brother had told him. And I don't think it's a universal rule or anything, but I think it's a good thing to keep in mind, and that is this, that a lot of times when you're writing a song, you're kind of like emotional. Like, you know, you're trying to resolve some sort of emotion you're having, and sometimes it can be like directed at an individual. So the idea of not you know, just really... You know, considering if you want to be like you know, like kind of yelling at someone, you know what I mean? But be a positive or negative, like a lot of times being more inclusive, using a we in a song can like bring people around rather than like, well, you're doing this and you're doing that, you know, like, well, we're doing this and we're doing that. Actually, like sometimes can make the listener. And then I've actually, because I've noticed that sometimes in songs when it's all, it's too preachy in the you form, it can actually be, to me, it can be a turnoff, you know? Because it feels a little attacking.
Or maybe even too much in the I form.
Yeah, or too much in the I form too, singular, whereas we, it kind of makes it, it's about, and again, this isn't a universal, there's amazing, like, amazing songs that are
it's
all about
to be aware
I
of.
And you. But also that I think there's some tunes that could be maybe more inclusive in the we form to, like, sort of bring everyone together in the experience sometimes.
So you could probably interchange like I and we and he and she.
Yeah, a lot of times you can.
In a lot of situations, and just see which one actually fits the message the best or something.
So I mean, that was years ago. I remember he talked about that like way back. I remember talking about that when we were working on like our first albums, and that always kind of stuck with me. And again, it's not a universal, but it's something I consider when I'm writing.
Mm-hmm. I think it's got to be something, you just got to do what you can get behind and embrace. You just kind of got to know yourself.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, certainly, like, the using the you pronoun worked great for Bob Dylan.
That's what,
like,
I mean,
You know, but he could get behind that.
Yeah.
You know, and it all worked with his whole thing.
Yeah.
His whole vibe. I mean, both of those, what you guys both said, I've heard before and definitely taken to heart. I don't think I work like a lot of people when it comes to songwriting, so advice and stuff doesn't really
it's hard to process,
do a whole lot of good, but but definitely, you know, but talking about the using specific things, details, as opposed to general, that has backfired on me before, because like if you use something specific but nobody knows that, but people,
it's too
don't.
Esoteric,
it's just
it's like in the club, you got to be in the
club. right or you've never been there, you know, you're like I've got this song that's got a place in it,
Tehachapi Mountain.
And I actually was a songwriting student that pointed it out to me, but she's actually a writer, you know, like a fiction writer. She's like, you repeat that a lot, but it's like, well, I was like, okay, well, what about Graceland? You know, like, he repeats that a lot. And she's like, well, everyone knows where that's at and what it's about. Like, they know what Graceland means already. And I was like, get out.
You're killing my
couple
dream.
Days later, after a couple of days, I'm just kind of like, oh, man, she's right.
I think like, I'm guilty of being very specific. I mean, I remember, like, when I first started writing songs in high school, I tried to model them after other people's songs. Like, I'd hear, like, oh, here's a song I like, and I wouldn't really know what I was talking about, like, lyrically. And I would even feel a little self-conscious about, like, singing this, like, emotional love song about, you know, and being like, I haven't even kissed a girl or anything. But, like, here I am, like, singing this, you know, like, whoa, what's going on with Zach, you know? But I'm just
– I may die a virgin.
Basically, you know, copying stuff that you hear, you know. And it's funny because as time has gone on, I've kind of gone back to some of those early songs and been like, actually, like, now that I know about some of those things, I was just copying, like, things that I'd heard other people say. Mm-hmm. But like somewhere in college, I remember writing a song. Well, I think it was maybe Ween that actually kind of inspired me to be like, I can just write about like what I'm thinking about and what I'm feeling, and like not
it's
really worry about whether or not if it feels good to me, it's going to resonate with other people. And that served me well for a long time. And then as like I've gotten like more adult, and you know, you start reading songwriting books and you read these little tips that are like, oh yeah, you know, try to find concrete details that I think that stuff is real. But what I'm trying to do right now in my songwriting process, and I've just written a bunch of songs, is to just go for it. Just write. Then like write that song, finish all the lyrics, and then go through a process of being like, okay, wait a second. Like when you use this word,
sit back with it.
It might make you feel a certain way, but it makes another person feel this way. So let's see if there's a better thing in there that can maybe, but to let that be part of the editing process and not so much the actual, but as long as you've got some of that initial inspiration that made you want to write a song in the first place, you know, and then not worrying so much about like there was the grail of like writing a hit song was always sort of like something that
has to be perfect.
Well, like, you know, if it's not, doesn't speak to everyone, then, you know, but
broad,
it was like, I've sort of just dropped that as a thing and just try to be like, if I could write something that is great for me, for my standards, you know, then that's good enough, you know, and I like some pretty quirky stuff. So it's, you know.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the song that you're playing for us today in the studio. or that you played for us in the studio. What's the name of the song, and what can you tell us about it?
The song that we played is called Not Old Yet, and it's a song off our last record that we put out, I guess, what, a year and a half ago?
Yeah.
Just about. Tangle of Time is the record. And that last record was actually really fun for us in general because we kind of came to it. We had some scheduling, you know, sort of restrictions. So we were trying to get ourselves all in the same place at the same time for just X amount of time. And we didn't have much, we didn't book much inspiration time. We just booked the studio, got in there, and we decided we just would bring our own songs into the studio and learn them there on the fly and just see if we can make a record quick. And so we all brought at least two or three songs, Zach, maybe a couple more. And that was one of the ones that I brought. And I kind of wrote it right before we went in. It was just sort of random, but it was I was driving my car, my check engine light came on, and my back was a little sore from the weekend gigs or whatever. And I was just realizing I was kind of like slowing down, kind of like the way my car was. My car might not live full. It's going to go soon, maybe. And that'll happen to all of us at some point. But I wanted to give it some hope, and I wanted to give it as much, you know, life as I could give it. So I was just, the song's called Not Old Yet, and it's kind of about, you know, trying to live young and live your dreams and take care of yourself. And it also kind of references being old and being young, and it's sort of like a time.
It's a perfect example of like, I mean, there's like things that are super specific, like a fondue pot that like you had for your 40th birthday was like a fondue party, where it's like obviously the listener might not know that, but I kind of think it makes it,
Interesting.
Makes it interesting.
I took a lot of specifics that were just from that moment that made it in there that I didn't even think about very much.
Yeah.
Because I massaged the lyrics, but I did just let it all fly pretty quick, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of something that goes back to your last question that I was thinking about, actually, was that personally, one thing, I don't know if this would be a tip about writing, but like when you feel it flowing, it's awesome. But trying to do it when it's not, I really don't enjoy that process, because I'll just set it aside.
It's like trying to find metal on a beach.
Yeah, it's not having it. But when it's when the flow is there, it's like just, it's so great. It's like the funnest experience, because these things just come out of you and it feels very effortless.
Yeah.
And a lot of times with me, if it's not feeling that way, I've had times in the past where I've tried, because I'm like, I want to have this kind of kernel of an idea, and I'm trying, and it's like I've learned to just like set it aside, because that's not necessarily the time to.
Yeah.
Because in the end, I might sometimes spend a lot of time and then come back though, and not too. Be happy. Yeah, sometimes you have to work to find it too.
Like that one, I remember driving down to Santa Cruz and back a lot and just like going over the lyrics, and I was like just trying to get it right. Mm-hmm. And using my audio app on my phone to kind of help me.
Yeah.
There's a real, God, I mean.
I was sort of struggling with a lot, but it eventually landed in a place I was pretty happy, you know. So.
It's a little bit like you're on the hunt, you know, like when you get one and you're like, I got this thing.
It's
and
close.
You're like, and then sometimes I've had the same thing too, where I like worked and worked and worked on it, and I was like, it's just not working.
You're like banging your head against
the
wall.
But then I've come back like 3 years later and you're like, oh, it was just, there it is. It's done, you know.
Yeah,
like.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can taint it by over.
Yeah.
Like you can burn yourself out on it, you know.
There's a great book on all this, that Songwriters on Songwriting book.
Yeah.
You get that. That's, yeah.
It's like this. Do you know about that?
No.
It's amazing. It's like, it's a big, thick book, but it's all these interviews with like all the songwriters you can think of, you know.
Great songwriters.
Yeah. Tom Petty and Neil Young and Paul Simon. And the gist of the book in the end is that like it's different for everybody. You know, like a guy like some of the examples that always popped in my mind is Neil Young, how his whole trip, he says, is he has to write it in one sitting, or if he doesn't finish it one sitting, he throws it away. So he's like, all his songs, you know, have just been written when he sat down and either finish it. And you hear that a lot. Like he throws the first verse in at the end a lot of times, and he's just comfortable with that. Whereas Paul Simon talks about how he, you know, it takes him a really long time to write a song, and he like goes over
pages
words.
And pages
and
pages,
it takes him a year to get like, you know, a good 7-10 songs, you know. And then Tom Petty like doesn't want to talk about it. He's like, I think it's a
blank
mystery.
Chapter.
It should be a mystery. Like, so his is real brief. He's just like, I don't really want to talk about it.
I do think what they're all getting at though is that like you're doing a dance with the unknown of creativity, and you're trying to have that come through you in whichever way, and like you're filtering this, you're channeling.
Yeah. But they all seem to have like a way, a lot of them at least, they talk of like they have their personal like way that they do it, which is kind of interesting. But it is all the same in a way because it's just maybe it's going even way back with this conversation, just trying to create the right context for your inspiration.
You need to know how to turn the channel on
you
yourself.
Learn about yourself like and how to get
it's
inspired.
Weird too. I mean, sometimes like the inspiration comes when I'm like totally depleted, like sleep deprived, you know, and you're like, oh, here's a new song. Mm-hmm. You know, like right when I thought like there was nothing I could do. Yeah.
Just came out.
And sometimes I also feel like you'd make something, you don't even really know if it's any good or not, you know?
Yeah.
And then you like you give it to someone and they're like, dude, that's perfect. That's great. Like, I mean, I feel like Old Yet, I wasn't even sure if it was like a song. And I kind of gave it to you guys and you're like, it's pretty darn close. Like, let's just work on it a little bit. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's hard to see the forest from the trees. Like, you know.
Yeah,
it's hard to know if you even have something because you're so buried in it.
I really appreciate like people listening. Yeah, like a lot of times I send songs to Steve to be like, hey, is this, you know.
Just to get some feedback. Outside.
Yeah, just like, am I crazy?
Clear your head a minute.
You know?
Yeah.
All right, well, I think that'll do it. Thanks you guys so much for coming down and being guests on the show today.
Yeah,
thanks for having us.
I forgot to give the address of that website.
Oh. Yeah, what is it? I was going to ask you that, actually, and then we got on something.
Trumpocalypse-clock.com.
Say, how do you spell it?
Trumpocalypse, Trumpocalypse-clock.com.
Now, if you watch this clock, will it make the 4 years go faster or slower?
Way slower, but you will be amused by the graphic and on the About page, there's a little essay on there about work training or work retraining, which is – I know it sounds random, but that is actually a key component to bringing jobs back to America because there's plenty of jobs. They're just different jobs. And I've got some links on there to some different websites, government programs that will retrain people for free. And actually pay for your college and then give you a job afterwards.
Dude, adaptation.
I appreciate
can't
the call to action.
I've noted. I've heard about this. Yeah.
Well,
and actually,
my Facebook page.
that'll be really helpful for me when there's a robot doing these interviews.
Yeah, exactly. And a robot giving them.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So the job for you is robot.
Yes, songwriting
robot
is
polisher.
Very easy.
Robot songwriters.
Oh man,
that's
just
a song.
The songwriting. There's somebody was like, I haven't heard the song, but they're like, there's an algorithm that's now. You kind of type in like, you know, I want a love song, and they're like, it's pretty good.
Yeah, there's a robot folk song. That's out.
Wow.
Folk song.
Yeah. So.
Oh, scary.
Yeah.
Our jobs.
All right. Well, thanks you guys for being on the show before the robot apocalypse comes. Yeah. I appreciate it. Justin.